This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. If you've ever traveled internationally, you've probably had the experience of being told you're the face of America to the world. If you're polite or rude, knowledgeable or oblivious, for better or worse, you stand for the other 313 million of us when you're abroad. That's unofficial, though. Imagine being the official representative of the United States in a faraway place. Joining us to talk about that experience is Alan Katz. He returned earlier this year from a stint as the ambassador of the U.S. to Portugal. Now he's teaching back here in Kansas City at his alma mater, UMKC. Ambassador Katz, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
I'm pleased to have you. You know, I'm sure our listeners today are dusting off their resumes since there's an opening now in Lisbon.
But not for long.
Not for long. They've got someone in mind, don't they?
Yes, they do.
How does someone get to be an ambassador?
Well, there are a variety of different ways. We have about 200 ambassadors around the world. Approximately 150 of them are foreign service officers. The other 50 come from different walks of life. In some cases, they could be academia. Could be from politics, from business, and generally speaking, for those of us who did not go through as career foreign service officers, what happened was that we were, in my case, I got to know President Obama before he was president, worked with him and a lot of his people throughout the campaign, and was invited into the administration, and this turned out to be the place that worked out the best for us.
So I don't want to be crass about it, but they're plums. Are they rewards?
Well, you know, the interesting part of that is the short answer is yes, but they are not indiscriminately given, and the reality is that the vetting process is one that requires a very hearty soul in order to endure. I recall at my swearing in sort of pointing out that the process, as I said at the time, put a lot of strain on good people and good marriages. But what happens is that those of us who got to know people through this process, we were involved in a large number of different endeavors throughout the campaign. And in most cases, we had done other things in our lives, which theoretically at least qualified us to be able to carry out the functions that were necessary.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about kind of your life leading up to this, but let's start with even something more basic. What is an ambassador anyway? What does an ambassador do?
Well, an ambassador is the president's personal representative in a foreign country. And in that capacity, all employees of the federal government, regardless of what branch of government that they're in, or what agency in the government that they're in, with the exception of those places where we have an active commander in the military. But all others are under the supervision and control of the ambassador or chief of mission, as he's called.
And so tell me about a typical day in the life of an ambassador to Portugal.
Well, the only thing that is typical is that there is no typical day. What you wind up doing is, in the case of Portugal, for example, we had approximately 200 employees at the embassy. We also had a mission in Ponta Delgada, which is in the Azores, and we had a small office in Madeira, all of which are part of Portugal. We did everything from people who needed special visas, which was the consular section. We dealt with a lot of so-called public diplomacy, cultural exchanges. I would deal on a fairly regular basis with senior members of the government. Portugal served on the Security Council while I was there. We had the NATO summit there while I was there. So there was a plethora of different activities, all of which, even though the relations between Portugal and the United States are very good, there were a number of things that were fairly tense. There were, shall we say, a few misunderstandings along the way. And really the question is dealing with them, which in my case meant establishing personal relationships with key members of the government so that when we went through things like the WikiLeaks, And things came out, some descriptions of some Portuguese government officials that were, shall we say, less than laudatory in some of those cables. These are the things you just have to manage through them. And fortunately, I was in a position to be able to do that.
Was the WikiLeaks scandal the most challenging, most conflicted thing you did?
Well, actually not. Actually, Portugal was one of the three joint commands that NATO had. And as part of the NATO reform, they wanted to close one, and Portugal was the one that made the most sense to close. But NATO is also a consensual organization, which means everyone must agree before they could take an action like this. So getting Portugal to agree to do something which was politically not particularly desirable, particularly as they were going through an election, was, shall we say, challenging. But we were able to work it out, and there's now a NATO striker force there, which is not as large as the joint command was, but frankly more effective. The other thing is that Portugal served on the Security Council.
At the United Nations.
And when they were elected to the Security Council, they received an awful lot of support from Africa and from the Arab world. And one of the key issues back then was whether the Palestinian desire for admission to the United Nations was going to come before the Security Council. Now, in order to come before the Security Council, you need 9 affirmative votes. The United States had said we would veto it if it got there. We were able to convince Portugal to not provide one of those 9 votes, and therefore that it never came up for a vote.
So in a way, you were a lobbyist for the United States in the
halls of power. Well, basically what
you're
doing is you're taking the United States' interests and what you're trying to explain to your – in this case, our ally – this is very important to us, and this is why it's important to us, and we hope to bring you around our way of thinking.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. My guest today is Dr. Alan Katz, former U.S. Ambassador to Portugal. He just returned from his service abroad. I want to invite our listeners, if you have a question for Ambassador Katz and his about his experience, you can join the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888. 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. I think a lot of folks will imagine ambassadors in their mind and think not so much of the hard work of being an ambassador, but sort of the pomp and circumstance. Was there some of that too?
Well, of course there's some of that. And it's interesting because I often tell people that I never worked harder in my life, and I always felt I worked fairly hard in my previous profession, but I never enjoyed anything more. The real problem there was a significant amount of formality, which on the surface sounds like, gee, wouldn't that be a lot of fun? And the reality is that, you know, yes, it is for about the first 6 months, but the formality and the fact that people are constantly sort of watching everything that you're doing and saying, I must confess, gets old rather quickly.
And before you were doing this, you were a lawyer, a lobbyist. I have to think life at the embassy is pretty different than your life before you were at the embassy.
Yeah, well, it's very different. I was an attorney, and actually I had fortunately given up lobbying for about 10 years before that, but nonetheless I had done it in my past. And I was also a local elected official in Tallahassee, Florida. So it was a combination of things. This was very different, and at the same time it was extremely rewarding to be able to represent your country, and you see your country through very different eyes in that capacity than you ever did before. And for me, it really was a sort of a revelation.
I'm curious, did you have any particular connection with Portugal before this?
No, but the irony was that my wife speaks Portuguese because she had been in the Peace Corps in Brazil many years ago.
Oh.
So she was for the first time ever, the wife of an American ambassador spoke Portuguese. And as a result, we were able to make friends with people who had never been friends of an ambassador before and probably never will be again.
How large a staff does the embassy in Portugal have?
We have close to 200 people.
And you're in charge of all of them, but there are people who are there before you get there and they're there after you leave.
Well, it's interesting. What you have is this. The Portuguese people are there before you get there and before you leave. The Americans rotate every 3 years. And so what happens is that after you've been there a couple of years, you are the senior American official there in longevity as well. And I remember telling my senior staff, I have more historic memory now of Portugal than any of you, which should be frightening to everyone.
Indeed. So one thing is for sure, like a lot of people in public service, you probably could have made more money doing something other than being an ambassador. Why would you want to do this?
Well, this is a great opportunity. This is the job of a million lifetimes, because you get to do something that if you think that you have a certain skill set and you've developed certain skills over your career, you get to bring them all to bear here and you get to do it on behalf of your country. And it's really it's just an enormous honor in that way to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And frankly, there are, you know, are more important things in life than money.
I'm curious if there was one particular memorable experience you had that really characterizes your whole life as an ambassador.
Oh, it's hard to settle on one, in all honesty. One of the most interesting ones was that when because Portugal is a relatively small country and everyone knew that my wife spoke Portuguese, the president of Portugal was coming to the United States, and we were able to arrange a meeting for him in the White House with President Obama. And we were sitting there in the Oval Office, which, of course, to me was very exciting, and I was trying not to gawk too much. But the two presidents were talking. At the end of the meeting, President Obama looks over at me and looks back at the president of Portugal, and he says, Mr. President, he says, I want to tell you about my friend, the ambassador, Alan. Here's an old friend of mine. When he speaks for me. And then he smiled, and he said, even though his Portuguese is not as good as Nancy's. And they all knew my wife spoke Portuguese, and so it was a very nice moment.
That's Alan Katz. He's a former now ambassador to Portugal, but also now distinguished professor here at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So welcome to the UMKC community.
Thank you.
You went to college here?
Yes, I did. I graduated in 1969.
Are you from Kansas City originally?
No, St. Louis, actually.
Okay, but you came across the state.
Yes.
What'd you major in then?
History.
And did that serve you well?
It actually served me very well. It was a good program. I went off to graduate school first and realized I did not have that love for scholarship one needs to pursue that. So I needed a trade, so I went to law school.
So now you're back to teach.
Yes.
As a distinguished professor. What are you going to be teaching about?
Well, I taught teaching a course this semester, and the course is called Money and Power, how incivility led to gridlock in Washington from 1960 to the present. And when I showed up for class the day the government had shut down, I pointed out to my students, in case you thought we were having a theoretical conversation, we were not.
Now, you're teaching in both the public affairs area of the Block School of Management. You're also teaching in the political science department.
It's a joint appointment, right? It's a course that pulls from both departments.
Do you think academia is where you'll stay?
Well, for a while, I'm enjoying it very much. And actually, next semester, I'm going to be teaching a different course, which basically is going to be aimed at those students who are in the not-for-profit sector, and we're going to be actually developing a strategic plan for a program called the Village Square, which Kansas City will become the national headquarters of.
And so how long is the time frame for that program? Will it be here for a while?
Yeah. The Village Square actually started about 7 years ago in Florida, and the idea basically is putting together Democrats and Republicans in the same room, having something that's enjoyable, having civil conversations, and having a topic that people can talk about and hear from some people on a fact-based conversation as opposed to an opinion-based conversation. The idea really is that there's been a lot of talk about civility, but a lot of the organizations are sort of what I would call the eat your broccoli types, which are telling you what to do and that you should be more civil. This is aimed at engaging people in a sense of community, which frankly we seem to have lost.
You've had a chance both as part of President Obama's campaign and then as part of the administration as an ambassador to see that on the inside. What do you think are the ways forward for our nation's political system? We're witnessing a time that does not appear to be its best days.
Well, I think, and this is why, frankly, one of the reasons that I took this position at UMKC after discussing it with Chancellor Morton when I came out here to give a commencement address about a year and a half ago. I told him about the Village Square, that what we had started in Florida, and by the way, we just received a grant from Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, to create one in California. And I said, I'd like to create the National Center here in Kansas City because I think that ultimately what we need to do is we need to get people to recognize the fact that we've always had extremists with us on the left and the right. Right now, they're dominating the debate entirely too much. We're not going to eliminate them, but basically I think most people find themselves center-left or center-right, and we need to let that dialogue begin to dominate the process. And the only way to do it, it seems to me, is to getting people in the same room to talk about these things and recognize the fact that just because I disagree with you doesn't mean that you're a bad person or that you're an evil person or that you have two heads.
Rigorous exposure to the political process that most people ever get would be testifying before Congress at your own confirmation hearings. What was that like?
Oh, that actually turned out to be a relative non-event. In fact, the rule basically is if they're doing 80% of the talking, you're in good shape. And by the time you get there, unless it's a controversial nomination, it's pretty pro forma. It's just more that the process itself drags on and on for reasons that seem to have no particular value other than the fact that that's the way they've always done them.
And is that when they're doing the security background check and all of that?
No, that part, that's a different form of agony. And what happens is that it's extensive. And part, a lot of it you understand, of course, and some of it you find to be somewhat a bit opaque. But I think that the really difficult part is just that it just takes a long time once you've been fairly well vetted just to get through the process just because it's very cumbersome.
I've read that the Portuguese American community was actually lobbying for someone else to receive.
Well,
the
they wanted someone of Portuguese descent, which I understood. But when I went back and met with the Portuguese American community shortly after my first trip back, I think we were able to we worked very, very closely. And I think that at this point you would find the Portuguese-American community felt that they were well represented during my tenure.
As you reflect on how America is seen in Portugal, in Europe more broadly, maybe in the world as a whole, where do you think we are today and what does the future hold?
Well, I think that, you know, I think sometimes we underestimate how important we are to the rest of the world. I think that we sometimes forget that we are seen as the great hope and the great center of freedom, the center of economic growth, and that we represent something that a lot of people, certainly in Portugal, are striving towards, you know. Mm. That doesn't mean they agree with everything we do, but they don't have to. There is still this reservoir of goodwill is so great. And frankly, it surprised me. I didn't understand it until I spent more time there.
Would you do it again? Can you do it again?
I can do it again. I would do it again, of course, given the opportunity. I think that after, you know, the part of the question really becomes, too, is that when you live outside the country for an extended period of time, even though you come back from time to time, but if you have a family, the question is that, you know, you think long and hard before you run out again.
I want to thank our guest. That's Alan Katz. He's formerly ambassador to the Republic of Portugal. Now he teaches here at UMKC. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Look forward to coming back.
All right. You can subscribe to our podcast. You can hear this conversation again, or you can access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page at kcur.org. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. We'll sit down with the maker of the film God Loves Uganda and explore its connections to Kansas City as we explore that country's reaction to homosexuality. Up to Date is next with how technology has changed our views on early miscarriage. Also, journalist Bob Woodward and another edition of 90 Mile View. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.